Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A federal judge in Cincinnati last week temporarily blocked an Ohio ban on abortion after a fetal heartbeat is detected. The decision benefits both abortion rights supporters and opponents. Abortion rights supporters are pleased because the ban won't immediately take effect now. And opponents celebrate what is seen as a next step in their hopes of reversing the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling that granted abortion rights to women nationwide. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us, Columbus Dispatch Public Affairs Editor Daryl Roland. Welcome, Daryl.
Happy post-July 4th, Ann.
Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. Welcome.
Good morning.
And Cincinnati Enquirer Columbus Bureau Chief Jackie Borchardt. Welcome.
Good morning.
No one is surprised by this, okay? So this is normal. So far, it's dog bites man. What's the next step, Jackie?
Well, the ruling last week is just an injunction while the case proceeds. So, you know, the next step is to have they'll have a ruling that'll be appealed. It'll go to the Sixth Circuit. And then whatever the Sixth Circuit decides kind of decides the next step. You know, several states now have passed these heartbeat bans that ban abortion at once fetal cardiac activity is detected. And so the question is, which appellate court is going to have a different opinion than the precedent that will send it to the Supreme Court? And so there's some thought that the Sixth Circuit, which is more conservative than, say, like the Ninth Circuit, will be one that maybe their opinion differs enough that it will be appealed to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court will take that case.
It's when the circuit courts start to disagree with each other that they want to resolve.
Because, I mean, that's how it works. Why would you waste your time when the lower courts already got the job done for you?
And not exactly on a very sticky subject. You wrote that proponents of the heartbeat bill say a heartbeat is a better standard than Roe v. Wade standard of viability. And I'm wondering, what's the argument for that?
They're saying that, you know, medical advances in medical technology have shown that the original standard of viability, which was set at about 24 weeks, mm-hmm. that because of advances in medical technology, you're seeing babies being born earlier than that are surviving because of all the, you know, different interventions that they can. The 6 weeks argument comes from they point to statistics that show that once you can detect that fetal heart activity, the chances of that fetus surviving all the way to birth are very high. You know, of course, that ignores all sorts of other pregnancies that maybe don't make it to the point when a heartbeat is detected. I mean, most, you know, doctors all have kind of different practices and methodologies around this. Sometimes, you know, a woman makes it to the doctor's office and she's about 6 weeks and they find a heartbeat using a transvaginal ultrasound. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, if the pregnancy is intended and there's no reason to think that something may go wrong, they may not, you know, they may do that at a later appointment around 8 weeks or something. So, I mean, there's some flexibility in there. It's not, it's just pointing to a statistic and saying that once this is detected, you know, I forget what number it is. It's a high number, though. It's like 90 mm-hmm. some percent make it. It's that's not, you know, opponents would say that is not medical science showing that is viability at all. And even in this hearing, in this court case here, they didn't actually provide testimony to show that is a viability marker.
And that's all those statistics getting to the 6 week mark. That statistic is just more about, you know, are you going to have a miscarriage or not? But there's all sorts of other variables that anti-abortion restriction people or people who are pro-abortion are saying, well, there are all sorts of other variables to take into consideration other than just will the baby make it to term. Then there's the restrictions that they would like for rape and incest and mm-hmm. all those other things too. Instead of just make it to 6 weeks, then there's a high percentage of the baby.
Right. And it also doesn't take into account fetal abnormalities or, you know, other issues that may arise later in the pregnancy. So it's not a scientific claim, just to use that statistic?
The transvaginal, well, first of all, listeners, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. You just heard from Jackie Borchardt. She's the Columbus Bureau Chief for the Cincinnati Enquirer. Also with us, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau and Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch, where he is public affairs editor. The law requires the use of transvaginal ultrasound. It's when a doctor or technician inserts the probe about 2 or 3 inches into the vaginal canal.
So it doesn't. It doesn't require it.
Okay.
The bill is silent on what
gotcha.
Type of ultrasound is conducted, and that's why you'll see some supporters of this bill push back against calling it a 6-week ban because. You know, they're saying that, well, if it doesn't say which one, then obviously they'll choose to do the abdominal, and abdominal will not pick up the heartbeat until later on in the pregnancy. So they prefer to call it more of like a 10-week ban. But because it's silent, opponents of the bill say, well, it could technically still be a 6-week ban because that's when it can be detected with a transvaginal ultrasound. But the mm-hmm. bill is silent. And some other states have taken different approaches. They've either said, yes, it has to be one or the other. And that's why you'll see some states with heartbeat bans that are technically, 12-week bans versus 6 weeks.
Okay. The same judge delayed another law signed by former Governor John Kasich that would have banned the dilations and evacuation procedure, which is the most common method of ending pregnancy, second trimester pregnancies. And I'm wondering, where is that in this web of issues surrounding abortion now?
I think there's also an appeal in the works to appeal that ruling as well. And that kind of plays into, Anne, what you were saying, the larger issue here when it comes to the court battles is that Ohio Right to Life and other abortion restriction or anti-abortion advocates have said that what they really want to do, their long game is to make it to the U.S. Supreme Court to challenge Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. And so, that D&E ban, the 6-week ban are all these pieces on the chessboard of making it to the U.S. Supreme Court to have some sort of overruling or to try to go for that overruling of Roe v. Wade.
Daryl Rowland, let's talk politics. This is all happening coming up as we enter into this 2020 election cycle, a huge cycle, obviously, for president and lots of congressional seats, of course, all of them.
Sure.
And all kinds of not statewide elections otherwise in Ohio. But how does this play out? I mean, the Democrats nationally are having a big debate about whether that should be an absolute.
Yeah. Parties, I think, have gone to, I don't want to call them extremes, but have taken hardened stances on both sides of this issue. It's more and more rare to find a, shall we say, pro-choice Republican and a pro-life Democrat. It's probably even more rare to be found.
Mm-hmm.
But both sides got what they wanted from this court, this initial mm-hmm. court ruling, because, yeah, they want a confrontation. Now, that's not going to happen. They want a confrontation in the U.S. Supreme Court. That's not going to happen before the next presidential election.
Okay.
It would be extraordinary for that for the courts to move that fast.
Okay.
You mentioned the D&E. That's been many months, and that's just sort of been sitting there. And many other restrictions are still pending at various levels. But what it does, I think, is fuel passions on both sides of the political divide on this perhaps most divisive of all American political issues. My colleagues Jessica Werman in our Washington Bureau, Kathy Gandisky here in Columbus, did a story about that very fact, who the pro-life and the pro-choice groups, when they have their demonstrations or ask for volunteers, they're getting more and more people. Because I think for the first time, perhaps, and it's because of the new composition of the Supreme Court, there is at least some prospect that Roe v. Wade could actually be reversed. And that threat, of course, is always there. But it's more real now than it has been in a long time. So if you like Roe v. Wade, yeah, boy, I'm going to go out and campaign and give money and volunteer and whatever to support that cause. If I think, boy, finally we can get that thing erased from 1973, I'm going to do the same on the pro-life side. So I think you're seeing an increasing activism, and how this all fits in to this larger maelstrom of contentious political events, you know, I think it's just going to exacerbate that whole stew. Mm-hmm.
If you look at the political makeup of the Ohio Republican Party and just the established Republicans here in Ohio, now when you talk to them about Donald Trump, you would hear a lot of them wouldn't hesitate to support the president. But you have to remember back before the election in 2016, there were a lot of traditional Republicans, establishment Republicans, who were on the fence for their nominee Donald Trump and wouldn't say if they would vote for him or not. The big swing for a lot of people who were hesitant about voting for Donald Trump, for these people who are Republicans, was the issue of court appointments and appointing judges and appointing people to the U.S. Supreme Court. When I would talk to people who seemed to be on the fence, and they would say, hey, you know what, it came down to the line, but at the end, I'm going to vote for Donald Trump. And you would ask them why. They would say, well, I'm against his stance on this, 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 and this, but he has promised to appoint conservative judges to the bench.
And now he has.
And so I think that's a big thing going for President Donald Trump going into his bid for reelection. And like we've said here, this issue might not get an actual ruling by next year's election, but it will be in a heated debate, and it might help somebody like Donald Trump to get those on the fence voters back on his side. But like we said, it could also help on the other side as well.
I just add though, yeah, I think Republicans have done a good job of getting that message across to voters, because like Andy, when I would talk to voters, I would hear that a lot from more Republican leaning voters, conservative voters, not so much from more liberal Democratic leaning voters. That the Supreme Court and the federal courts was a big issue, and they made it a big issue, and it was very successful. And I think they've also done that with abortion as an issue, in kind of rallying the base and bringing people out. And I think you're starting to see maybe a little bit more of that activity from the Democratic side of things, but certainly not to the degree that the Republicans have done.
We are talking politics and public policy today on our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Jackie Borchardt. She's Columbus Bureau Chief for the Cincinnati Enquirer. Also with us, Daryl Rowland, Public Affairs Editor for the Columbus Dispatch, and Andy Chow, a reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Columbus Dispatch Public Affairs Editor Daryl Rowland, Cincinnati Enquirer, Columbus Bureau Chief Jackie Borchardt, and Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. The budget has been delayed until July 17th. It could face another delay at that point. It's not unprecedented, but it is certainly rare. And it's very, very rare, if ever, they've done it when they've been so flush with cash. It's usually there's a shortage and not enough to go around, and they're fighting over how to, whether to rob Peter to pay Paul kind of a thing. How much – now, there were about 500 issues that separated the two chambers at the outset. Does anybody know what we're down to right now? And really, what are the big issues?
Well, that's what we asked Senate President Larry Obhoff. We said, well, how many issues are there? And he said, well, we started with 500. And then I think it was Daryl's colleague, Randy Ludlow, who said, well, can you whittle it down
exactly
for us?
Exactly 500.
And he said, well, it's not 500 anymore. So I think there are a handful of issues that are still out there. It sounds like if you talk to House Speaker Larry Householder, and just remember, both of these leaders are both Republicans.
Right.
Householder said that it comes down to the tax plans, education spending and healthcare reform. These are the three things that he's been pushing for, saying that these are sort of the sticking points in negotiations when it comes to trying to reach a deal among the Senate and the House.
Mm. And it looks like the education plan, there does appear to be a way out of the jungle on those, where both Larrys, if you will, Senate President Larry Aboff and House Speaker Larry Householder. They have mentioned that they may just do a moratorium on the sticking points, and the sticking points are basically two. One is state takeovers of troubled schools, schools that are not meeting state standards. It's one of those things where almost no one likes the way this is being done now, but a new solution is what's proved elusive. So the way out of that may be moratorium on state takeovers, and then we'll perhaps consider separate legislation to figure that out. Maybe the same on grade card changes as well, graduation requirements, I should say. That's the bigger sticking point. Again, they may just kick the can with current standards and say, let's get the, you know, take that out of the budget negotiations. We'll consider that separately. Let's move on down the road. I think Andy's exactly right. I think Speaker Householder told me they were technically a couple pages worth, but I think a lot of those are – we're down to the big three. So if you eliminate – those major education concerns, you're down to so-called health care, you're down to tax cuts. And basically, do we restore, or how much of the current tax cuts do we keep intact, basically, for the small businesses? Actually, they're not necessarily small. They're just businesses that are passed through entities. In other words, instead of you creating a corporation and you pay a corporate income tax, you usually just put it on your 1040. So, and then that's because the income is passed through. And those are limited liability corporations, some partnerships, things of that nature. They've gotten a tax cut of about $1.2 billion a year for the past few years. The House cut that almost in half. The Senate would restore almost all of that. So that's the sticking point. And Householder, frankly, taking a point of view that many Democrats have taken, says, you can't show – this was touted as a job creator. You can't show me any jobs, number one. Number two, 86% of the people would still get the tax break under the House pass plan, where they're cutting almost half of it. So you are debating about the richest 14% of these income holders. And, you know, Householder saying, is this the hill you want to die on, Senate? And the Senate says, yes. And the DeWine folks are saying, yeah, we shouldn't be, you know, because now it is a tax increase. When you reverse a tax cut, you can legitimately call it a tax increase. And I'll talk about the health issues later.
I think it's important to note too that on that tax question, you know, Governor DeWine has proposed, well, why don't we pull that out too? Kind of the same idea, like with the education pieces, and the House leaders, both Larry Householder and Democrat Amelia Sykes, both said no. I mean, that's not an option for us. It needs to be something that needs to be worked out in this budget.
So when you zoom out of this budget negotiation, just look at how the Senate and the House have been operating as a whole for the year so far. You've had them clash on the transportation budget, where they decided to increase the gas tax. You've had them clash on the Bureau of Workers' Compensation budget, which also had a delay of 30 days. So you're seeing this tension between the Senate and the House. So when Daryl mentions things like pulling it out of the budget and working on those issues as separate pieces of legislation, I think what you have is members of the Senate and the House thinking, well, we might have the most leverage here in the budget, where we might not be able to have that leverage outside. If we're just, you know, dealing with this mano a mano, maybe we won't be able to get what we need. But if we have it in the budget, we can push it through the way we want it to get through. So you've got a lot of negotiation, a lot of tension between the Senate and House when it comes to dealing with these things, because you got to remember, when the Senate passed their version of the budget, it was supported unanimously. It was supported by Democrats and Republicans, and there was wide amount of support on the House side too with their budget. So this isn't necessarily a Republicans versus Democrats thing.
Yeah, and just, you know, these are points of difference, but to the average Ohioan, this tax cut is some dollars and cents. It's not a huge you know, for someone making $30,000 a year, Under the House plan, they would save $44 a year from the proposed tax cut. And under the Senate plan, it's $46. So it's a difference of $2 for someone making $50,000. It's, you know, double that, about $90 under the House plan and $96 under the Senate. So, you know, these are more philosophical debates that they're having here. And you know, Larry Householder has said that it's a fairness issue for him. And, you know, why is half of this going to 14%? And, you know, if someone is making, you know, $60,000 from just doing their job for a company, they're paying taxes. And someone who's making $60,000 as a independent contractor is not paying any of the taxes to the state. And so, you know, that's kind of where he's coming from on that.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Enquirer. Also with us, Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch and Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. So is there any sense that it's going to go beyond that 17 days?
Well, interestingly, we're, you know, we're now halfway, basically halfway right into that period. Mm-hmm. And
can they fix all this in a week?
Well, I swear, this is like when my kids were in sixth grade and the science fair project was due the next day. So maybe it's time to start on it now, right? The Senate, well, first of all, Andy referred to the big picture here. You know, for folks who were asking us a year or 9 months ago, why are you paying so much attention to that House Speaker's contest between Larry Householder and Ryan Smith? Mm. What does it matter?
Who cares, right? Mm.
Now, folks, this is why it matters. You have an entirely different House mm-hmm. now. And, you know, again, as my colleagues have observed, this is, and we've said before, this is more chamber versus chamber mm-hmm. rather than D versus R. Republicans control everything. But Larry Householder has changed the dynamic, and Republicans have changed about, hey, you know, to the outsiders, this is picayune things. But traditionally, you go into a conference committee, you start dealing with the Senate passed budget because it is the freshest document. The House does it first, then the Senate. So the Senate's the most recent. Reportedly, Speaker Householder said, no, we're working from our budget. And, you know, and oh, by the way, we're not going to bring the governor in just now. We're doing it. So he, you know, he departed from the norm. We have a president who departs from the norm, so maybe it's the culture here. But things are really being shaken up here, and he's being very insistent. And so far, the Democrats in the House have largely hung with him. Ironically, the Democrats in the Senate have largely hung with President Larry Aboff here. So that's the conundrum here.
I figure they know their members, and they know what they need to throw in there to keep and really a relatively few number of people happy and on board. From the other party.
And it's interesting. It's, you know, longtime state legislator Vern Sykes talked about on the Senate floor before that bill passed. It's not like it was going to be a no vote because, you know, there's all this stuff I don't like in it. But by and large, there's more stuff that I like. So I'm voting yes, as did every Democrat. So they're, you know, the Democrats don't like this tax cut because they see it as totally misguided. But yet in the Senate, they're hanging with the Senate version because of the other things they're getting. So, okay, we're 8 days in. The House made a big show of working. You know, we were ready to work to the deadline. Larry Householder, you know, stayed in Columbus, didn't even drive back home, worked till 3 o'clock in the morning, he was telling me, half implying what are the senators doing. Well, last week, you know, the House was kind of took a break, said they, you know, we worked really hard. The Senate tweeted out pictures, we're working on the budget, see? So you've got this backdrop of little sniping and things of that nature. So there's got to be a little healing perhaps done.
I thought that the Senate tweets about photos of working on the budget was more in response to the photos of senators fishing with Governor Mike DeWine.
Yeah,
that's how I took it.
And representatives, you mean?
The governor tweeted a photo of several lawmakers, including senators.
On Fish Ohio Day.
On Fish Ohio Day.
That's right.
And you got to remember, July 1st is like the unofficial
stop time.
Beginning of vacation for all these members. They think that they assume that, you know, they've been working for months on the budget. Once they pass the budget by June 30th, they plan for these vacations. They plan to take this time off. So, you know, like last week, just a day after the temporary budget was passed, you didn't see a lot of, you know, inner workings at the State House. You didn't see people rushing around saying, hey, we're on a temporary budget here. We got to get some. It was just, you know, a ghost town.
It wasn't panic in New York City.
Right.
And by the way, shout out to the LSC, the Legislative Services.
The real heroes in this situation.
Yeah, and the aides and everybody else who does have to stay behind mm-hmm. and make the lemonade out of the lemons.
Well, there was a moment on Saturday night where it was apparent that the Senate, that they were not going to get an actual two-year budget through, so they were going to work on a temporary deal. And so they said, okay, that's the vehicle we're going to use now. And you could just tell that all of a sudden a button was pressed and now LSE has to rush to get this temporary deal crafted into a bill instead. So, yeah, there is a lot of work being done that night.
The school spending issue, House wanted to provide funding for low-income districts and wraparound services at public schools. The Senate spends the money on vouchers for private schools. Is that right?
For
some of it.
For school,
some of it.
For okay. Ed Choice, I think, for and then also for more funding to school districts that are seeing a growing enrollment. So there is a pool of funding that the House devoted towards wraparound services, which are usually devoted to low-income school districts to help with services to those students. That money was diverted to those issues that we mentioned in the Senate plan. So yes,
and the faster-growing school districts tend to be more affluent and wealthy suburban districts. Mm-hmm. And so there's where the dispute lies with the House. Again, Larry Householder, from Perry County, who, you know, comes from a rural school background, and that wraparound money could help a district like he serves. And now it's going to, you know, more affluent, wealthy suburban
schools.
A lot
of Republicans come from more rural areas, though, which is what surprises me about that. That they're not.
And I think what you just said is getting reflected more in the House,
right,
where it is divvied up more, where people are very specifically serving those
smaller districts, right?
Yeah, and I think that's why you saw the increase of wraparound services in the House, and I think that's why you also
less so in the Senate, though, where the districts are larger.
Yeah,
and they have.
Okay. And I think that's why you're also seeing this push to reduce that small business tax deduction to the first $100,000, because you have these Republican members in smaller low-income districts who are thinking that money could be used elsewhere.
And of course, this foreshadows the debate that we'll be having in a couple months on the larger issue of how we fund public schools in Ohio.
Yeah, I want to talk about that later on too. I'm kind of, you know, as everybody knows, I've been on vacation. I'm playing catch up. Daryl Rowland, you had a story top of the page today about the pharmacy benefit managers and how that whole issue plays into the budget wrangling. What's going on?
That's right. Pharmacy benefit managers describe a middleman in the drug supply chain. They affect how much pharmacies get reimbursed from the state. They affect how many taxpayer dollars are used on drugs. They are in the middle. They decide both those rates. So after our reporting for the past almost a year and a half now, everyone wants reform. The governor wants reform. The attorney general wants reform. The House and the Senate both want reform. The House and the Senate, so they both want to go after pharmacy benefit managers, rein them in, regulate them more thoroughly, what have you. And they both would like to help local pharmacies. Their approaches are very, very different. My story today focused on, this is one of the things that has been rolled into the budget. It is one of the things that has created the stalemate, where we're on the interim 17-day budget now. And I had one of the experts, he's the lobbyist for Ohio Pharmacists Association, Antonio Chacha, has been following this for, at least a couple of years, been buzzing the legislature. He loves the intent of both the Senate and the House plan. He thinks they have a good heart, they both have good ideas, and neither will work. They do not address the problem thoroughly. Part of it is, what is the role of these pharmacy benefit managers? Are they just going to be removed? The House wants to create the state's own pharmacy benefit managers. He worries if cost then just becomes the total bottom line oriented, cost efficiency as opposed to healthcare quality becomes the equation, that pharmacies are still going to suffer. The Senate, on the other hand, will keep the PBMs in the supply chain. They want to give $100 million to pharmacies, and who's a pharmacy lobbyist to say no to something like that? But he says as long as the PBMs, pharmacy benefit managers, have their finger on the scale, they're going to control where a lot of that extra $100 million
goes. Why are pharmacy benefit managers required? Because in some, there's lots of states that don't have them.
Well, there's a few that don't have them in some form. West Virginia, the most notable, or in a way, they still have them, but it's all done through West Virginia University, home of Gordon Gee now.
Okay.
But Ohio's not wanted to get away, go to that model for whatever reason. And I'll admit, I'm not 100% sure why that is. In the beginning, pharmacy benefit managers, I mean, as its name implies, they sound like a little paper pusher or accounting.
Like an HMO type of thing.
Well, a little bit, and not even involved that much in health care decisions.
Uh-huh.
But now it's CVS, it's Express Scripts, it's OptumRx, and I've just named 80% of the market nationwide. Mm-hmm. So they're multi-billion, and many billions of dollars that are also merging all the time. CVS wants to merge with Aetna. And create these almost, some would, critics would say, these are vertical monopolies, vertically integrated monopolies to provide health care. So they have now great control over the prices. And before they were in the middleman, they would rake off a cut. The state tried to eliminate that by saying, whatever the state pays you, what do you got to give pharmacies? Especially CVS Caremark says that's great, but we are going to tilt which pharmacies get the business. And for specialty drugs, we're going to mark the prices way up, as much as 20 times what the actual cost is. And oh, by the way, we're also going to require specialty pharmacies prescriptions to be filled by our own specialty pharmacies run by CVS. Some would call that self-dealing. No one's made that accusation legally yet. But this is what the legislature is trying to tackle. It's a complicated topic.
But it's a pocketbook topic. It affects
everybody. Every taxpayer. It affects your health care costs. And, it perpetuates monopolies that few people think, I should say, alleged monopolies, oligopolies, if you will, mm-hmm. that few people think are good for the health care system. I mean, everyone from President Trump on down has railed against this current setup. So it's just like, okay, guys, how do we get out of this briar patch?
Mm-hmm. We will continue talking politics and public policy if you stay with us. So that was Darrell Rowland. He's public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch. Also with us, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Enquirer. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Columbus Dispatch public affairs editor Darrell Rowland, Cincinnati Enquirer, Columbus Bureau Chief Jackie Borchardt, and Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. Real quick, there's been a new bill introduced regarding the school funding issue. The first Cut-Patterson school funding formula, way too much favored wealthy, fast-growing school districts. This one, not so much. What's the big difference, Jackie?
Well, I mean, I think the latest kind of numbers on some of the – what they did is they took all the criticism about their initial plan, which did receive a lot of praise, actually, for trying to figure out the actual cost of educating a student in Ohio and funding that cost. Mm-hmm. And then also providing some funding for different variables like gifted education and transportation and all those other different factors that may change what that standard cost is. And so they did get a lot of praise for that. But like you said, they got some pushback once you actually saw the numbers and you saw which districts were getting large percentage increases and which ones were not. And so they've tweaked it and they're going to you know, they've started rolling it out over the summer. They may have some informal meetings, but the formal discussion of the bill won't start until the fall. And it's still some of the same criticism that you're seeing these faster growing districts getting percentage increases. And it really ties back to what I just said about trying to find a cost. Right now, we're operating under a Band-Aid formula that doesn't, it's been a Band-Aid for several years. So it's not even a true estimate of what it costs to educate a student. And two, any formula that's going to be based off enrollment is going to give more money to districts with more students or who are seeing an increase in students. You know, what they're trying to do is at least protect against some of those huge increases and also protect against some of these smaller districts losing too much money because, you know, there's some fixed costs and that's hard with education to drop funding from one year to the next because you have some of those fixed costs. So, you know, anytime, I just think this is going to be an issue going forward, just based on what they're trying to do. It's really hard if you take those numbers and compare them to current or past years. Like, yeah, of course, the faster growing school districts mm-hmm. are going to have more money and a larger percentage because they get a lower share of their money from the state anyway. So, yeah, I don't know that percentages are even the best measure because if you're only getting $100 per student, and that's not a real number, I'm just hang with me, $100 per student, and now you're getting $200. Like, whoa, that's a huge increase percentage-wise. But there may be another district who gets more of a per student per dollar increase, but it's a lower percentage. So I don't know. I applaud them. I think it's a great idea to take it outside of the budget, where for the past 8 years and even before that,
but
it's always been a budget discussion.
Done if it's outside of the budget.
I think that's where it needs to get done because I think the problem of having it in the budget is always you're always comparing the numbers to the previous years. Mm-hmm. Everyone applauds, oh, the changes in school funding, this sounds great, it sounds more fair. And then once you see the district by district runs and you see which schools are winners and losers, then the debate changes. And that's when you have like the House, for example, usually the House because they have, you know, smaller districts and they're closer to their people, you know, their local school boards and superintendents are calling them saying like, hey, we're going to lose money. We're not going to get as much. We need to, you know, push back on this. And that's what's happened the last 8 years.
But you're going to have the spreadsheets and the district breakdowns wherever it's debated, whether it's in a separate bill or whether it's in the budget.
I disagree because I think when it's in the budget, they're thinking more of we have X pool of dollars and we're going to need to spend, you know, divvy that up by Y. And what the Patterson plan is trying to do is to actually create a new school funding model. And of course, you know, former Governor Ted Strickland tried to do this as well. And then when they put the price tag on it, everyone got sticker shock. Like, mm-hmm. whoa, that's really expensive. Well, education is expensive. And so I think, you know, that's the benefit of taking it out of the budget is that you're able to say, look, let's take away that X pool of money and just look at what it costs and what the state share should be for these districts. And let's have the larger debate of what the state should pay for education.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen it's hard enough to get a budget through without even talking about the school district funds. So, like, if you're talking about how much money Jackson City Schools is going to get compared to Worthington City Schools, compared to Columbus City Schools, mm-hmm. and then you're also talking about the small business tax deduction mm-hmm. and Medicaid reforms. So I think I agree with Jackie that if they take it out of the budget, they can have a debate purely on this and talk about try to get away from just glancing at the numbers and looking at the percentages and really asking themselves, is this dollar amount going to this school the right amount to help fund that child's education through all his or her variables, through all of their different things that they have to go through, whether it's transportation or whether it's, you know, are they getting meals when they're at school and those types of things. I think it'll be a better debate to have it outside of the budget.
You know, I agree 100% with everything my colleagues have said. However, you take it outside the budget, where's the money going to come from? Mm-hmm. Right now, the projection is, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jackie and Andy, $600-700 million
for
those first 2 years.
Yeah.
And this is a 6-year implementation. So that is just, if you will, the first third.
So if they pass the bill separately, then when they get back together again, it would be 2 years from now, right? I mean, or would
they're talking. Right now, they're talking about starting this a year from now,
and so
the next
state
fiscal year.
Then.
So they would, yeah, they'd have to do a mid-biennium update, and you know, we had those under
cases. It's not like we haven't done those before. We have.
But you know, they're going to say, "Well, gee, we've already sort of allocated all the state money in the budget process. Where's this $600 or $700 million supposed to come from?" Number one, and you know, number two, this strategy of withholding the spreadsheets has been tried by this group both times now. They've rolled this out. So this last time, I just did a public records request. I said, you've got a cost. There's got to be spreadsheets that show how you arrive at its cost, folks. And that probably means a district-by-district rollout. So, you know, we did a piece, I guess it was a week ago Saturday, showing how this would affect Central Ohio. We're putting online today. Sorry for the free commercial, folks, but we're putting online today. Anyone can go to dispatch.com and look up what your district would get. The current year is there, and both years, and also the dollar and percentage increase. Now, again, is that relevant to discussion? Is that a discussion stopper? A lot of times it has. We've all been around long enough where it does. The plan sounds good, but ooh, I got four schools in my district that are getting cut. I can't really support this. Going in, however, spreadsheets unseen, this bill already has 66 co-sponsors. That's two-thirds of the House. Hmm. That's veto-proof right now if they all stick to it. So we're going to see. Again, everyone, I think, lauds Representatives Cupp and Patterson. That's an R and a D, folks, working together. Well, and they've pulled in people from all around the state, school officials, all sorts of education experts.
They've put a lot of work into this. But, you know, you make that salient point. It's R and a D. But what about the House and the Senate?
What about the Senate? Yep.
Yeah.
The Senate has not been largely not part of the discussion thus
right,
far.
And this is not something a bill that's being introduced there concurrently.
And this is something that Larry Householder, again, is a personal issue for him and something I think he would very much like to see done on his watch in the next year.
Oh, that's an excellent point, Jackie. And because Cupp and Patterson wanted to have actual hearings this summer. Mm-hmm. And he says, no, I am going to personally devote July, August, and the first part of September to working with these folks to come up with a viable formula. I mean, he would love this to be a legacy.
And then start hearings in September.
Yeah, mid-September, yeah. Mid-September, and, right. Of course, if he could pull it off, you know, anyone would deserve to have whatever statue people want to make out of it.
Because it's been 30-plus years.
Tea leaves, he has said this is a priority. I think he wants to get the budget through. I think he wants to get the energy bill through. But then he says school funding is a priority. But I don't think it's exactly where he would like it to be so far. So those 66 people who are co-sponsors, I think a lot of them are Democrats. I think a lot of them are people who were not necessarily Householder supporters when the vote came in January to vote for a speaker. So there's still a little, you know, I think the people that still need to support it, top among them, Larry Householder, might still be on the fence on a couple of issues.
Lawmakers missed another deadline. The June 30th deadline that First Energy had set for a bill that would bail out its nuclear power plants.
Yeah.
What's the holdup there? Who wants to grab that one?
The House passed its own plan, which would subsidize nuclear power, giving the plants about $150 million. Every ratepayer, everybody who pays an electric bill, would see an increased charge on their electric bill to help those nuclear plants. Yet the House says that their plan would still bring down your electric bills because you would no longer be paying riders or subsidies for renewable power and energy efficiency programs. That bill stalled in the Senate. The Senate committee tried to bring back some of those renewable standards, some of those energy efficiency standards. These are programs that help incentivize development of alternative energy. So the bill stalled. It didn't get passed out of the Senate committee by the June 30th deadline, a deadline that was set by First Energy Solutions, so a corporate deadline, not a deadline set in the Ohio Constitution or anything. So it still remains to be seen. First Energy Solutions said, we need a decision by June 30th or we're going to continue down the path of shutting down our plants, first Davis Bessie and then Perry.
So are they continuing down that path?
Well, it depends on what your definition of continuing down that path, because they still could. The issue here is that they need to buy the rods to go on with their refueling process, which is supposed to happen later this year.
they still have time to buy those rods. They're saying, well, now that they missed their June 30th deadline, it's going to be more expensive to buy those rods. So,
but we could still do it. That's
yeah, that's what they're saying.
Their line right now is that they could still do it. There's still time.
So they're like, I know you missed our deadline, and I know we said that we're going to, you know, close down. But you know, if you still give us money, we'll still take it.
Well, right, and those fuel rods are, I think, $54 million was what FirstEnergy's consultant that has brought them, bringing them out of bankruptcy, FirstEnergy Solutions bringing them out of bankruptcy, has testified to. Those do have, you know, I'm a long way from a nuclear engineer, but it's my understanding those have to be custom made. It's not like you can just
go pick them up at Walmart,
the nuclear Home Depot or Lowe's or whatever, you know.
Nuclear Home Depot.
Yeah.
It's in their cart, though. I mean, they've ordered it before, so.
Yes, and other people have purchased nuclear rods. They've also purchased.
Yeah.
And
okay.
So I think we might see that. I think we're still going to see activity on that bill within the month. But there's still a huge amount of sticking points, again, between the House and the Senate.
57 amendments pending.
Yep.
And well, so, and again, it's a difference. Larry Hausler is at the heart of this. I talked to someone close to negotiations who said that even the budget impasse revolves around House Bill 6, which is the they don't like the name, but it's a nuclear energy plant bailout.
The other thing here is that if you're going to make changes, if you're going to look at those, like you said, 50 plus amendments, you have to talk about it and really think about it, because there were some changes made in the Senate plan that are now part of the substitute bill that all the utilities are very upset about, because they say it will really increase their costs when it comes to energy efficiency. I think what the Senate committee was trying to do was try to save some of these energy efficiency programs, keep them around for a little bit.
Like for wind and solar, that kind of stuff?
Well, efficiency. So, okay. You know, LED light bulbs, those kind of things. What helps you not use the energy in the first place? But again, it was getting confused with renewable energy standards. And so utilities are saying that the costs weren't really considered when it came to those changes. And so the utilities that I've talked to have said it's actually going to increase electric bills if they continue forward with that plan. So it's all a jumble right now.
And, you know, the issue of, you know, this was originally touted as a clean air bill, oddly enough. Now, you know, and soon it became, hey, we're subsidizing coal plants with this quote-unquote clean air bill. And yeah, we're removing the subsidies for renewables and green energy sources.
The big winner from this bill, of course, are the TV and radio stations that are playing all of
these
ads.
Dollar,
you know,
ads.
More than $8 million estimated at this point. So
Just like a election year.
And 200 plus lobbyists, by the way. You probably are not getting poor.
Full employment for the lobbyists. Real quick, we have about 3 minutes left, and I just wanted to devote all of it to the issue of a public health crisis that has been identified by conservative Republican lawmakers. They're looking to the House of Representatives to declare pornography a public health crisis. Pornography a public health crisis. Now, it's just a declaration. It has no meaning. It has no bearing on anything particularly. But why public health crisis? Why that route?
I mean, so this is a model legislation that's been passed in about a dozen states.
Alex?
No, it's okay. From the National Center on Sexual Exploitation. And they this is from their website. They call porn a, quote, social and physical toxin that destroys relationships, steals innocence, erodes compassion, breeds violence, and kills love. And their main argument is that it, you know, it's linked to human, can be linked to human trafficking. Human trafficking victims are, you know, forced to perform in pornography against their wishes. You know, about a dozen states have done this. But like you said, there's no funding tied to it. It's more of a, you know, way to raise awareness. My colleague Jesse Ballmer looked a little bit into kind of the other side of the argument, like is it really a public health crisis? And some of the research that she came across, it was mixed. That there isn't necessarily a clear line between, you know, pornography and increased domestic violence or human trafficking. So you know, this resolution, of course, was introduced in the middle of the whole budget debate. So it was, you know, a brief moment of levity, I think, during that confusion.
Not all maybe of a sudden, the look they were looking for.
Right. I mean, it was, you know, on a Sunday night, you know, as we're heading towards the budget deadline, that resolution was read. And again, then all the lawmakers kind of went on vacation. So we haven't really had a hearing on exactly why this resolution's around. So it'll be interesting to hear it.
More fodder for future Weekly Reporter Roundtable. Andy Chow, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And Daryl Rowland, that's Andy Chow of Ohio Public Radio, State House News Bureau. Daryl Rowland of The Dispatch, thanks to you as well.
Another fun ride. Thanks, Ann.
And Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Enquirer, thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.